sisters. I want to see a sea of hands out there. Let me see a sea of hands. I want everybody to kick up some noise. I want to hear some revolution out there, brothers. I want to hear a little revolution. Brothers and sisters, the time has come for each and every one of you to decide whether you are going to be the problem or whether you are going to be the solution.
That's right.
You must choose, brothers. You must choose. It takes 5 seconds. 5 seconds of decision. 5 seconds to realize your purpose here on the planet. It takes 5 seconds to realize that it's time to move. It's time to get down with it. Brothers, it's time to testify, and I want to know, are you ready to testify? Are you ready? I give you a testimonial. The MC Factor.
I guess my question related to this influence of like indigenous cultures and movements around radical politics is going back to what we were talking about before. I think the motherfuckers were really unique in that they were trying to blend kind of countercultural youth culture with radical militant politics.
Correct.
And kind of synthesize them in a way where they weren't opposed or they weren't siloed or something. And that's where things like psychedelics or health food or natural birthing, like all these other practices, which don't fit into a kind of
right
dogmatic militant thing, become just as important. And it seems like
they become important. I don't know. I don't like the term just as important.
Right.
They become very important. Yeah.
Right. Well, I guess what I meant is like a normal kind of dogmatic militant wouldn't kind of see those as like.
But that's what's wrong with the normal dogmatic militant.
Right.
In other words, you should be able to understand what it is to eat healthy so that you are following some, you have an immune system that can withstand some of these. The pandemic is forever. There's going to be pandemics continually. This is not the last one that's that you're now. You have no immune system left. So eating properly and teaching people and how, but I don't think militants have to do that, but somebody has to do that. It's important. The people should know how to eat that helps their body to withstand these diseases that are a result of capitalism. I mean, we have poison water, poison air, poison food. I mean, this capitalism has poisoned the world. So it's important to show people how to resist that poison, how to be healthy, it's not as important as actively bringing down the system, but it is extremely important.
Yeah, and it seems like we were saying, like the Beats, you know, post-war were kind of rejecting a certain American kind of lifestyle or something. But then, you know, 10 years later, like with this kind of countercultural thing, it seems like hippies or whatever in the back to land were looking to like indigenous ways of life and ways of thinking and spirituality and kind of ecological thinking as another kind of rejection of America, this kind of decolonization or something.
Which is correct.
Yeah, even if you didn't use that term.
I mean, you need it. See, like people think capitalism is just an economic evil. It's not just an economic evil. It defines our entire existence, culturally, health-wise. I mean, just think about it. You got Marxists running around, leftists running around saying you should have a vaccine. You know, so like here, all of a sudden, the giant pharmaceutical companies are no longer an evil. They're actually saving you. They're not saving you. They're the ones who poisoned you, and now they're trying to give you an antidote.
Do you think the vaccine works?
I think I mentioned this to Matt before. I'm not anti-vaccine. It's up to a person. You want to get vaccinated because you think it might afford you some extra help. But I am a totally 100% opposed to the concept of vaccination as the solution. The solution to this problem is not vaccination. The solution to the problem is the elimination of toxicity. So in the meantime, while we're working toward eliminating toxicity, if you want to get vaccinated, it's up to you. I'm a non-authoritarian. It's fine. Do it. But the concept of vaccination as a solution is wrong. It's the exact opposite. It's not only not the solution, it's actually a prolongation of the world of toxicity. The pharmaceutical company, think about it. They're making billions. They're not out to help you. They poisoned you, and now they're selling you the antidote.
Well, I think that they're trying to get people back to work. So I trust them to try to uphold public health to the extent that they want people working.
And the way to getting you back to work, they want to make $1 billion off of getting you back to work.
Sure. I mean,
so not only they're going to make money by you working, but they're going to make money by vaccinating you to get you back to work.
I mean, I think one of the things with this idea of toxicity is like, you know, the capitalist industrial society has toxicified the world for centuries now, but we don't live for centuries. So we're kind of stuck in this middle ground. So to untoxicify the world now is going to take longer than our bodies are going to be alive.
Correct.
So we have to be forced to make these compromised decisions to like, how do we untoxicify our, you know, temporal existence on the planet?
If you want to get a vaccine to so you could make it to that, then it's your choice. It's up to you.
Right.
But I want to make it clear that the concept of vaccination is not a solution.
But even aside from vaccine, it goes back to the pipelines too. Like the way the world is constructed, it's like there's all this stuff that's been built for centuries or something, you know, the bridges and the subway systems and the water grids and the electrical grids and the oil grids or whatever. And it's like it's been built and developed for so long now that it's going to take a long time to unbuild it and destroy it or figure out how to live.
But we got to start somewhere. Now we should start. So you could do it step by step.
No,
you can't.
You're
not going to do it overnight. Let's say it took 1,000 years to fuck it up. It was going to take 1,000 years to correct it. But it's still, that doesn't mean you're not going to work to correcting it.
No, for sure. I'm not disagreeing with you. I just think it was an interesting idea you had of this, the toxicity that's been built and what does it mean to kind of live in a toxic environment, which we do. You know, like we're in Hell's Kitchen or whatever. So it's like, how do we, or Ridgewood, Queen, wherever we live, how do we kind of live within this toxic environment and kind of survive and build, you know, whatever, our way out of it.
That's what each person has to find. So therefore, I think it's helpful to know what foods strengthen your immune system. What, you know, to find little simple things. You know, and if you want to get a vaccine, that I can't fault you. I personally am not in favor of it. But it's up to you. I'm not opposed to you. I don't feel you're betraying anything because you get a vaccine. But I don't want to overemphasize this, but I want to make it clear that the concept of vaccination, I'm opposed to.
What are some other issues that you're interested in today that you think younger anarchists should be involved in?
Like simple things, like this idea of learning to be self-sufficient. Learning, you got to learn to survive without the system that you want to destroy. You don't know how to grow anything. You don't know how to hunt. You don't know how to repair things. And yet you want to destroy the system. In order to destroy the system, you got to learn. So people should be, I'm in favor of people learning how to grow food. I'm in favor of people hunting. Totally. I'm in favor of people learning to repair things around their environment, not have to call a plumber or call. I mean, there's so much to do. We're like infants. We don't know anything anymore. We have allowed the system to run our lives. They feed us. They nourish us. They doctor us. They repair things for it. I mean, fuck them. We don't need them to do all that. We've got to learn to do those things. And we don't. And it's going to take time. And Matt's correct. It's going to take a lot of time. But we got to start. Like I live here, I don't have any heat. You know,
You don't have a space heater?
I don't want to contribute to Con Edison if I could try to live without heat. Hmm. I mean, we all make little choices of how to survive or how to do. Like I try to eat healthy. Like I try not to eat poisonous food. I intake no sugar whatsoever. I use whole foods or, you know, I mean, we got to make efforts. It's not a revolutionary effort, but we got to learn to do little things.
I think a lot of people might be interested in that today because they see, instead of revolution on the horizon, they see some kind of major collapse.
Like that's exactly
it. As a result
it.
Of climate change or correct. Another pandemic or
right.
something like that. Do you think that that's a more likely horizon for political change than revolution?
I don't like to use the term more likely, but it is definitely a possibility. So therefore, it would be good to learn. Mm-hmm. So it's ironic that, so here you have people anti-gun. In other words, I'm not anti-gun. I'm anti-psychotics having guns, but I'm not anti-revolutionaries having guns. If they don't have a gun, how are they going to defend their land that we're talking about where you grow your own food? How are they going to hunt without a gun? Learn about, I lived in the wilderness for 5 years. In the wilderness, did nothing but hunt and gather to see if it's possible. And I did it for 5 years. And I preferred not to use a gun. I preferred to use a bow. So I practiced, but I was never good enough that because my life depended on eating meat. So you got half the left want to be vegetarians and they don't know how to grow food. So they try to kill vegetables.
But so 50 years ago, you know, you moved, relocated, you know, a lot of your life to the southwest of the U.S., you know, Colorado, New Mexico, and that region. How have you seen that region change, you know, ecologically or socially or politically or something? You know, we often talk about New York, but what's changed over there in terms of the dynamics, you know, the political or social dynamics and environmental dynamics?
The marginalized communities are stronger today than they were when I got out there. Like Native people are definitely on the move. They're strengthening. Their culture is strengthening. Chicano people. There is definitely far superior to what it was 40 years ago. But we're not there yet. But we're on the way. So when Native get the land back, you know, which they should get back because it was stolen. But, you know, then there has to be time for people to understand and talk about, like, how they're going to live in this land. And the way Native people lived before Europeans came here was fantastic. They shared things. They had a non-authoritarian society for the most part.
But then the last like 10 or 15 years, you spent more time again in New York City or something.
Correct.
How do you feel about this kind of dual existence that you have or these relationships you have to New York and the Southwest and the kind of different trajectories they've been on or what they mean to you, you know, politically or
but
existentially?
I came back here about 10 years ago and by my being here, I'm able to do other things that I could not do out there, which I was happy to do what I did. I was young. I could live in the mountains. I can't live in the mountains now at 80 years old. Hunt every day, 4 o'clock in the morning, 12 hours, 15 hours hunt. So, you know, so like I had to, plus I'm able to do things like that we're doing right now, interviews. Out in the West, there's no interviews. I can't talk about what we did in the 60s, how it's relevant today. So since I came back, I mean, there's at least 26 different books or editorials about what went on in the 60s that I could contribute and how those ideas might be useful today. But I couldn't do that from out in the middle of the wilderness. So it's not a matter of one's better than the other. You do what you can do at each moment in your life. At 80 years old, you're not going to go out and fight cops. But that doesn't mean you like cops. Or that you quit fighting.
Do you want to talk a little bit about your art? I know you're still a working artist.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I lived in the wilderness, in New York before, let's go back for a minute, before Black Mask, I was an artist. During the Black Mask period, I combined art and politics. As we moved into Up Against the Wall, I became more on the political side of things and not art really, except for posters and those efforts, like communication efforts. And so maybe I'm losing my thought for a minute. But in other words, at one point I was an artist. At one point I was almost pure political. And then I became very interested and committed to an understanding of what Native spiritual life was like, what they had. These were people that could go to war to defend themselves, but still were not afraid to pray. I mean, this concept that the Western man has is that somehow spirituality means you don't defend yourself. It's absurd. It's ridiculous. It's a pure European misnomer. Spirituality, you know, like the Bhagavad Gita, spirituality always had a defensive side. So anyway, so I was an artist at some point. I was political at some point. I became more involved with Native spirituality at some point. And I reached this point now. I call it the unified field, where my art, my politics, and my spirituality are actually all combined. I feel less schizophrenic. I don't feel like, well, I'm an artist. Oh, I'm a political activist. Oh, I'm a spiritual. I really understand that this is one life. And that is the ideal for mankind, to be able to have all these elements in his life. Capitalist society has eliminated the chance for people to live fully. So like you're a worker, you're mopping somebody's floor, but you're not allowed to have any creative outlet. Or you're not, I mean, in other words, a non-authoritarian society, a real society, a living society, people can contribute fully. They work to contribute to their life, their needs, they have a spiritual thoughts to contribute to their spiritual need. In other words, capitalism has fragmented mankind. It's made it so that they're in control, so you can only do what they allow you to do. So if you're a worker, they'll let you work, but that's it. If you're an artist, well, you could be an artist. But to me, that whole that distinction's absurd. Like an artist should be able to be artist, worker, spiritual. In other words, we want to be full human beings. That's the way we were created. That's how we were made to through this creation, is to be a full being, not to be a partial being. Oh, you can paint. Oh, you can work. Oh, you can pray. Man should be able to do whatever is the full gamut. And that's the ideal society that we should be looking toward.
It seems like a lot of avant-garde artists in the 60s totally understood this. Like, I was actually reading something about Warhol recently, and he said exactly the same thing. He said that his mission with the factory was to make art and life indistinguishable. Do you think that that kind of idea of breaking down the divisions of the art world is lost today? Like, it just seems, it seems like today the art world is more capitalistic than ever.
It is more capitalistic than ever. But the capitalist saw that here was a cash cow. So in order to sell art, you have to go along with their program. They control the purse strings.
I mean, I think there's an interesting, I'm curious to get back maybe to the historical trajectory where it's like, so you have the 70s and there's this fragmentation that happens of the 60s youth cultural movement as maybe it becomes consumerist, or as, you know, the war ends, et cetera, and these various things sort of happen. But then by the 80s, you have this kind of yuppification of you know, the 60s kind of era, and you have people like Jerry Rubin or Stuart Brand or others like making a lot of money and kind of thinking that like the
Jerry Rubin was as phony as the as a $3 bill, man. Like, well, I'll give you an example. One time we had a riot on the street on Lower East Side. It was a Saturday night, so Sunday morning. You could get the Sunday Times. So here comes Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman, got their Sunday Times, and they all of a sudden passed this riot on the street. Jerry Rubin took his New York Times and ran home. Abby Hoffman joined the riot.
Right. But I mean,
so that'll tell you something right there about Abby Hoffman. And then he became a stockbroker.
Right. That's what I'm kind of trying to think about or get at. So in the 60s, you have this kind of peer pressure, social pressure, that people should participate in some kind of, you know, subversive countercultural movement. But by the 80s, that same peer pressure is now funneling you into like financial success or something.
And no, and you're funneling yourself into it. You're allowing yourself to be sucked into it so you could be comfortable and you could receive remuneration.
Do you think that was just with people's age, you know, as this kind of youth movement got older? Yeah. Or was it political that's or psychological? What happened in the 80s, basically?
That's what capitalism is. It finds a way to take control. So it took control of art. All of a sudden, they realized here were these guys running around, abstract expressionists, creating. And all of a sudden, like, they saw, wow, we could control it and we could make a fortune. And they did it. They took control. And now they make a fortune.
Yeah, there was this kind of scandal recently. I mean, I don't know if you saw with this, like, the Black Lives Matter kind of foundation, you know, and it was revealed that they had raised like $90 million and they spent $6 million of it on this house that just like a couple of them were living in. And there was like very little transparency. And it's, you know, it really makes you sad, you know, and it wasn't like, it was a kind of seemingly left-wing journalist that kind of uncovered this. And, you know, they have this obligation, I guess, to like report it, even though it's embarrassing for the movements to kind of reveal this information. But there's, I don't know if it's like just capitalist society forces people to kind of live like this and rip each other off and fuck each other over. And
that's what it does. But I don't like the word force because you can make a choice. Society, like I want to, I'm an artist, you as you said. So I want to produce art. I want to make art. It's like breathing to me. It's not like a commodity. So I have the choice. I could say to the gallery, well, fuck you. I don't want any part of you. I'm going to create something, but you're not getting it to sell it and make money. That's my choice. So you can't. So if I were to sell out, you would then say, well, I was forced. No, you make your choice. I chose to stay out of it. I paint when I went out, when I lived out west, I painted for 40 years and never sold a painting or shown a painting to the public. I just made a creative effort. It's not about money. It's not a commodity.
And I bought some of your art, and it's, I think, the only time I've ever bought art other than like a zine or something. I think you sell them on your Instagram, right?
Yeah, I do, not very much.
Okay.
But I do.
Yeah,
yes.
So if you're interested, you can check out Ben Morea's Instagram, and maybe if you're lucky, you can snag one. Right.
Or if you're unlucky, you can snag one.
Anything else you want to talk about before we wrap it up? I guess I had that question about the MC5. I don't know if you want to tell that story.
It's entirely up to you.
All right, maybe we can just close with that. Did you beat up the MC5?
Well, first of all, the MC5 had a song with the words "up against the wall, motherfucker" in there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first was introduced to them and met with them, I told them, you know, "up against the wall, motherfucker" is not a commercial phrase. It's a radical, it's intended to be a radical breakdown of society. And I objected. I felt uncomfortable with them using it as a commodity. And so one night, what they were going to play at the Fillmore East, which I'll just say quickly, we had the Fillmore East one night a week free for the community. Bill Graham said, when we first approached him about having one night free, his response was, "over my dead body." And I said, well, that could be arranged. Anyway, he then produced 3 silver bullets in his hand and said, "these were given to me by the Hell's Angels because they wanted something from me. And now you want something. So I'm just telling," I said, "yes. The only difference is, if we give you 3 silver bullets, they're not going to be in your hand. And we want the theater one night free for the community." And we took it. We occupied it and forced them to give it to us free one night a week. So the MC5 played there once. You know, like, we're non-authoritarian. The street people don't have rules. So the MC5 had the audacity to pull up in this fancy limousine and make like a big, like they're elite, fancy, and they were hassled by street people. And then they went ahead and said something like, "oh, well, we tried to play for the motherfuckers and they hassled us." You know, it was simple. They got out of a limousine in the middle of the street and the street people hassled them. There wasn't a motherfucker in sight. They were just the street people. And you don't blame them for hassling them, like pull up in a limousine. People barely have enough to eat. Never mind riding in the limousine.
So in popular memory, though, it's often told as if you controlled the street people or the people trying to get into the venue.
That's bullshit.
Okay. And it wasn't you personally.
In actuality, the street people controlled us, hopefully. More than we controlled them. We were one. We tried to be part of the community.
And in Rachel Kushner's Flamethrowers, have you read Rachel Kushner's Flamethrowers?
Yeah, I read it.
She retells the story as if it's you beating up Iggy Pop, which is, I think is kind of a weird change.
No such thing. I never knew. But, you know, and I liked her. I like her as a writer, but it was kind of absurd that she wrote a book. You first of all, it's supposed to be nonfiction. It's advertised as nonfiction.
It is.
But she chose.
It should be fiction.
Fiction. I'm
right,
sorry.
Right, right.
It's supposed to be fiction. But she chose to identify me as the person. So then it becomes nonfiction. And she put words in my mouth without ever talking to me. And actions that I did, like the Iggy Pop thing, there's never happened anything like it. But she could have talked to me, and I would have told her.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a work of fiction, then it's up to her. But if it's based on somebody, she identified the protagonist as me, then it becomes nonfiction. And so she should have addressed me and talked to me and asked me, if I say this, is it true or not? So it was a mistake, but, you know, we all make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I like the writing, but, you know, that was a mistake.
Yeah, it's not the best place to learn about the history of the motherfuckers, that book. But it is a good, not the best way to learn about the history of the motherfuckers, that book. But it's a good book.
And she could ask me. I'm open to discussing with anybody anything. Maybe too open. We'll be right back.